thighs, either just above the knees or in mid-thigh. If you get in a hurry and lose patience with the pull at this point, the usual result will be an early jump well below the correct level that will not hit you in the belly. This inevitably carries the bar and you forward. Or you might think that the bar actually leaves the thighs at the jumping position, but this is a misunderstanding of the motion. Drag the bar up in contact with the skin, never leaving the thighs. The bar must be in skin contact until it leaves your belly for an efficient vertical bar path. Take your time, and remember that fast happens at the top right now, not at the bottom or even in the middle at this point in learning the movement. The next position will be at the mid-shin, where the bar would be if it were loaded with plates on the ground. This position will challenge your ability to get into a good, mechanically correct deadlift, with the shoulders in front of the bar and the back in hard extension, because of the width of the grip. Compensate for this more horizontal back angle by making sure your knees are out far enough. Most people should touch the inside of their elbows with the outside of the knees in this position at the bottom if they are correctly set up, with contact similar to the deadlift start position. This knees out position gets the thighs out of the way of the belly and makes the more horizontal back angle easier to use. Make this a feature of the start position from this point forward. Reach out with your knees to touch your elbows before you squeeze up into the pull off the floor. Toes out enough makes knees out much easier. So adjust your stance now if your feet haven't already sorted this out for themselves. From this position, slowly pull the bar up the shins as the knees extend, then past the knees, and up into the mid-thigh, staying in contact with the skin for the whole pull. When the bar gets to mid-thigh, accelerate into the jump and rack the bar. Most people tend to pull the snatch too fast off the floor. Even after the movement has been learned correctly, the tendency will be to hurry through the floor pull, the first part of the pull from the floor, as it's called. Make up your mind now that the first part will be slow and correct, and that the explosion starts only after the bar is in the higher part of the pull. At this point, you're doing a full power snatch. Rest a second, put some light plates on the bar. Light plates. The power snatch is best practiced with light plates at first, especially if you're not already pretty strong. Light may mean lighter than the commonly available 10-kilo bumper plates. If this is the case, they will need to be obtained. They tend to be expensive, and their lack of availability may be a deciding factor in using the power snatch for trainees who cannot easily manage a 40-kilo load. If they're available, use them. They make the process of learning to jump with your gradually heavier load much more seamless than does an abrupt jump from 20 to 40 kilos. Too big a jump here often results in an arm pull and a complete breakdown in the careful progression we have detailed. Go up slowly and convince yourself that the snatch is a jump with straight elbows that ends with a drop, not a panic-stricken retreat into a wide-grip upright row. When the snatch is up to 40 kilo on the bar, loaded with bumper plates, most people drop the bar from overhead to the platform in one movement, letting the rubber do its job. Before the invention and widespread availability of bumper plates, snatches had to be lowered eccentrically. This requirement added another dimension to the workout that was probably quite beneficial, if less fun. If you have the luxury of bumper plates, learn to use them correctly. Drop them from overhead while precisely controlling the drop by not letting go of the bar until it's nearly on the floor. Make sure the plates land evenly, if at all possible. An uneven drop can bend even the best bars. It is fashionable in some circles to drop empty bars from overhead or to let go of a dropped bar from overhead. these circles need to go somewhere else to train because equipment is expensive and the gym must be respected as a place where you control your immature urges to call attention to your histrionic self. Okay? The power snatch is best trained with doubles, sets of two, or even singles. The pull is long, it is sensitive to fatigue, and sets of five or more reps will cause you to start making mistakes that would not happen were you not fatigued. High rep sets will very quickly have you practicing sloppy snatches. If your workouts entail more incorrect reps than correct ones, as they will if you use high rep sets, you will get highly proficient at snatching incorrectly. So limit yourself to two rep sets and accumulate workload by doing multiple sets instead of doing too many reps per set. Useful assistance exercises. The squat, the press, the deadlift, the bench press, and the power clean form the basis of any successful, well-designed training program. But there are other exercises that can assist these five and improve certain aspects of their performance. There are quite literally thousands of exercises that can be done in a well-equipped gym. Bill Pearl, in his classic book, Keys to the Inner Universe, includes a cursory descriptions of 1,621 exercises. Not all of these exercises are useful for strength training purposes, because few of them actually contribute to the performance of the core barbell exercises. This point is important for a couple of reasons. Your training priorities, which should depend on your advancement as an athlete, should involve strength, power, or mass. No matter how long you train or how strong, explosive, or big you get, your training will always be tied to the performance of these basic movements or their derivatives. The fact that resources, time, recovery, the patience of family and friends, are always in a shorter supply than we'd like makes the efficiency with which your goals are accomplished an important consideration. The best assistance exercises are those that directly contribute to the performance of the basic movements that produce the most benefit. Not that the basic movements need much help. They are complete exercises in and of themselves, since they all involve lots of muscles moving lots of joints in anatomically normal, functionally useful ways. But after a certain period of time, usually several months after serious training begins, the stimulation provided by the execution of the basic exercises alone is not enough to produce sufficient stress to cause further adaptation. This change is due not to any deficiency in the basic exercises, but to the trainee's ability to successfully adapt to the stress these exercises provide. A natural result of training is that progress slows down after progress has been made, and progress is why we train. These topics are discussed at great length in Practical Programming for Strength Training, 3rd edition. For example, an excellent assistance exercise for the bench press and the press is the chin-up. Chin-ups add enough work to the triceps, forearms, and upper back that the contribution of these muscle groups to the bench press is reinforced for the trainee who needs a little extra work. And this work is done using another multi-joint functional exercise. In fact, chin-ups are so useful that they are included in the program from very early on as the only non-barbell component of the program. A less efficient way to accomplish the task would be to add a triceps isolation movement like cable triceps extensions, a machine-based movement that, when done with what is usually considered strict form, leaves out the lats, upper back, and forearms, posterior delts, biceps, and grip strength. Since the bench press uses all these muscles, why lose the opportunity to train them all together at the same time with another multi-joint exercise? Chin-ups work better as an assistance movement, as do heavy lying triceps extensions, an exercise that is actually more beneficial when performed with what would conventionally be interpreted as less than strict form. Before we get started, let's discuss adding exercises to your program. Anytime a new movement is introduced, be conservative with the weight you use the first time you do the exercise. This is a lesson you will learn the hard way eventually, but it's better to learn it now. Anytime you try a new exercise, you'll be working with a movement pattern or a piece of equipment that you have not used before. Even if you're using a partial range of motion from a familiar exercise, you have not used that piece of the movement by itself before. You've previously used it in the context of the whole movement, and working it separately is a different mechanical task than the whole movement. It is sufficiently different that you have chosen to do it that way instead of the other way. You're not adapted to the new exercise, and as a result, it will make you sore, and perhaps very sore. The soreness may be due to the simple fact that you're doing a number of different reps with the assistance exercise than you use for the parent movement. A rep range to which you are not adapted will make you sore too. But a brand new movement pattern has the potential to go beyond simple soreness. It is one thing for unadapted muscles to get sore, and quite another thing for unadapted joints to get sore. Sore joints usually mean inflammation of the connective tissue, if not outright structural damage. Sore muscles mean inflammation too, but muscle bellies are vascular. They're supplied with lots of vessels and capillaries that carry blood to them to help them heal quickly, whereas joints are not. Joint soreness is a much more serious matter than muscular soreness or even muscular injury. Joint problems can persist for years, while muscle belly injuries will heal in a matter of days or weeks. And lots of sore joints start on the day you tried something new with as much weight or as many reps as you can do it with. Now, this is not to suggest that you be a weenie. It is to suggest that you be intelligent and prudent with new exercises so that you don't end up being an involuntary weenie later. This point is especially important if you are an older trainee. Start a new exercise with a good warm-up and only go up as heavy or to as many reps as you would consider being equivalent to a moderately heavy warm-up set, leaving something on the bar for the next time. This way, there can be a next time soon enough that you can proceed to make progress on the new exercise instead of having to wait for something to heal. Assistance exercises fall into three categories. These exercises, 1, strengthen a part of a movement as with a partial deadlift, either a rack pull or a halting deadlift. 2, are variations on the basic exercise, as with a stiff-legged deadlift. Or 3, are ancillary exercises, which strengthen a portion of the muscle mass involved in the movement in a way that the basic exercise does not, as with the chin-up. All assistance exercises of value can be assigned to one of these three categories. Partial movements. The deadlift, as mentioned earlier, can be brutally hard. When done with very heavy weights, as a very strong trainee would use, deadlifts can become very hard to recover from during the period of time called for in the program. A limit set of 5 in excess of 500 pounds might require a week or more for adequate recovery for the next workout, and in the meantime, squats have suffered as well. When your deadlift gets strong enough that heavy sets of 5 create more stress than you can easily recover from within the time frame of your training program, it becomes useful to alternate 2 assistance exercises instead of the deadlift. Halting deadlifts come from the floor up to the top of the kneecaps and cover the bottom part of the movement, and rack pulls are done from below the knees up to full lockout at the top. The combination of the 2 covers the entire range of motion of the pull while producing less recovery demand than the full movement itself. Halting deadlifts. The halting deadlift is done with a double overhand grip and from the same stance as the deadlift. Like deadlifts, haltings are pulled from a dead stop. A brief review of pulling mechanics might be useful here, so refer to Chapter 4 if necessary. The knee extensors move the load up from the floor. The hamstrings and glutes maintain the back angle while this happens. The hips then extend, and the spinal erectors keep the spine rigid in extension, so the transfer of force from the knees and hips to the bar can occur efficiently. The traps and rhomboids transfer this force to the scapulas, from which the arms hang, and the lats keep the arms back so that the load stays in position over the midfoot during the trip from the floor to the top of the knees and back down. Take a normal deadlift stance and a double overhand grip of the same width as for a deadlift. Lift your chest and lock your back into extension using the normal deadlift setup discussed in Chapter 4. In a deadlift, the back angle will start to become more vertical as the bar leaves the floor. Haltings are different in that you actively try to hold the back angle constant as the bar comes up through its whole range of motion to its position above the knee, so that the back gets worked harder through what would be the middle of the full deadlift. This is similar to the mechanics of the pull off the floor in a clean. Try to keep your shoulders in front of the bar until it crosses the patellas. The back angle will probably change before the bar gets to the patellas, but your job is to deliver as much work to the erectors and lats as possible by staying out over the bar as long as you can. This extra back work is one of the reasons for the exercise. The amazing part of this exercise is how much work the lats get while doing the job of holding the weight in position over the midfoot. Drag the bar up your shins until the patellas are just cleared, and then set it down. Don't worry about setting it down slowly, since the work on a halting is supposed to be mostly concentric, just like a deadlift. Remember, you're starting each rep from a dead stop. Bill Starr would tell you to hold the bar at the top position for a second before setting it down, and doing so adds greatly to the effort required of the back muscles and lats. It's very helpful to think about, 1, pushing the floor with your feet, 2, pulling the bar back into your shins as it comes up, and 3, keeping your shoulders out over the bar for as long as you can pull it that way. Breathing is the same as for the deadlift. Take a big breath before you pull and hold it until you set the bar back down. Start with 135 and then take reasonable jumps up to your work set weight. You will not do haltings in the same workout as the deadlift, so you will be as warm when you start them as you would be having done squats and presses or whatever the program calls for. Haltings should be warmed up just like deadlifts. Haltings seem to respond well to higher reps, but due to their shorter range of motion, work sets of, say, 8 reps will use heavier weights than a deadlift work set of 5 will, and possibly as high as 85% of 1 RM. At this load, 1 work set is plenty. Breathing takes place at the bottom and is the biggest problem during the exercise due to the bent over position. The last reps of a long set are no fun when you're out of air, and you can't really get a good breath in the start position. The grip is a straight double overhand or clean grip, as mentioned earlier, but with the same width used for a deadlift. Supinating one hand for a heavy single deadlift is a necessary evil in a meet, but multiple reps with one shoulder in internal rotation and the other in external rotation produce an asymmetric shoulder stress that some people do not tolerate very well. Haltings are very good for developing the grip, since you won't be using your 1RM deadlift weight for them, and the double overhand grip is harder than the alternate grip. So use the haltings as a grip exercise too. If you get strong enough that your grip strength is exceeded, then you can either use straps or a hook grip. Straps are fine if your grip is otherwise strong enough, in that you don't normally have any trouble hanging onto heavy deadlifts with an alternate grip at meets or at 1RM. Pay attention to keeping the bar against your shins on the way up. This is the lat's job. Haltings can be thought of as pushing the bar away from the floor with the feet at the bottom, and almost as a row at the top as the bar breaks over the knees, but obviously you don't bend your elbows. Rack pulls. Rack pulls are the other half of this pair of exercises. They are done from inside the power rack, from level pins, or from blocks supporting the plates from a point somewhere below the knees. How far below the knees determines the amount of overlap that the halting and the rack pull have with each other. Just below the patellas is probably not enough, while down to the mid-shin defeats the purpose of dividing the whole pull into two movements. 3 or 4 inches below the joint line is about right, just below the tibial tuberosity. The point of the halting deadlift is to work the initial drive off the floor, which depends heavily on the quads for the drive and on the hamstrings to anchor the back angle. The rack pull should use as little quadriceps drive as possible, with the main emphasis on hip extension, working the hamstrings and glutes, and above all, keeping a flat back while this happens. With hip extension as the primary point of the exercise, rack pulls are obviously done also from the dead stop. Your stance for the rack pull will be the same width as for the deadlift, but with your shins more vertical than they'd be in the start position off the floor. The bar should be in the position it would be were it deadlifted to that height off the floor. Bar over midfoot and in contact with the shins, just below the knees. Your shoulders should be in front of the bar, and it is very important that they stay there until the bar is well up your thighs. In this respect, both haltings and rack pulls differ from deadlifts, which allow the natural change in back angle to occur as the bar is pulled from the floor. Your back must be locked hard in both lumbar and thoracic extension. The chest is up and the lower back is arched but not overextended. This is a normal anatomical position of extension, the position described for the squat and deadlift and for all barbell pulls. It is easier to get in this position when the bar is higher up the shins because less hamstring tension is pulling on the pelvis and lumbar lock at this point. As with the halting deadlift, the rack pull is performed with a double overhand grip, usually with straps due to the heavy weights that are possible to use with this exercise. From the starting position, drag the bar up your thighs, keeping it in constant contact with the skin, with your shoulders out over the bar, your chest up, and your knees held in position with no forward movement. When the bar is high enough up the thighs that you cannot keep your shoulders forward, extend your hips forcefully. Shoot the hips is a good cue for this movement. The finished position is the same as for a deadlift, with shoulders back, chest up, knees and hips straight, and eyes focused on the floor 12 to 15 feet ahead of you. No exaggerated shrug is necessary, nor is it useful. The hips are shoved forward into extension with the chest held up, and this is all that needs to be done at the top. Shrugging concentrically with the traps is not the function of the traps in a pull of this nature. Breathing is also the same as for the deadlift, with a big breath taken and held before each rep. Sets of five work well for rack pulls. The weights that can be used are quite heavy, due to the shorter range of motion and the better mechanical position that you start from in a rack pull. And it is not uncommon to be able to do a 5RM rack pull with very close to your 1RM deadlift weight. Again, they should be warmed up with the same progression as for a deadlift. As simple as this movement sounds, it is very easy to do wrong. Most people will allow their knees to come forward as soon as the bar passes them, making the back angle more vertical and dragging the bar back up the thighs along an angle and supporting some of the weight on the thighs, instead of keeping the bar path vertical. This knee shift is illegal in the deadlift in the power meet, since the bar will actually go down a little and is referred to as a hitch. Your body wants to do this for the same reason the second pull on a clean works. You get a second opportunity to use the quads to straighten out the knees if you rebend them. But unlike a clean, the rack pull is specifically used to strengthen the hamstrings, and they must be made to do their job as intended, to pull the hips into extension while the back stays flat and to maintain the back angle in the hard parts of the pull. It is important to stay out over the bar, to keep the knees back, keep the bar on the legs, and extend the hips only after the bar is well up the thighs. Barbell shrugs. The barbell shrug is a type of rack pull that starts up above the knees at about the point where the hips finally extend at the top of the deadlift. Barbell shrugs can be done with very heavy weights, 100 pounds over your PR deadlift or even more, due to their very short range of motion and good leverage position. In fact, to be effective, barbell shrugs must be done very heavy. But they are an advanced exercise, and not everybody has any business doing them. The fact that they are done so heavy means that a novice lifter, unadapted to heavy weights, in terms of bone density, joint integrity, and motor control, can become very injured very quickly, even when doing them correctly. An impatient friend of mine broke the spinous process off of C6 doing these prematurely. Barbell shrugs are best left for competitive lifters who have trained for at least a couple of years, and there's no real reason for athletes who are not powerlifters or weightlifters to do them at all. They are included here for the sake of completeness, lest anyone think that they do not exist. If you're sure you're ready, set your rack pins or plate blocks at mid-thigh and load the bar to 135 pounds. A shrug is done like the top part of a power clean, and the best warm-up for a shrug is racking the bar on the shoulders with 135 from this high position. This warm-up establishes the correct movement pattern for the subsequent heavier sets and weeds out the novices. If you cannot easily hang clean 135 from a dead stop on the pins, then you have no business doing heavy shrugs. After a couple of sets of five at 135, add another big plate and try to clean it for five. If you can, good. If you can't, you have shrugged it. The mechanics of the movement should be the same as the second pull of the clean, the heavier weight limiting your ability to rack the bar on your shoulders, but with the rest of the movement intact. As the weight goes up, the bar will travel less and less, until for the last warm-up and the work set, the elbows do not even unlock and only the hips, knees, and shoulders move. The point of this heavy load is to make the shrugging muscles finish what the hips and legs have started. The key to the movement is the snap that must be used to make the traps work at the top. The bar will start up very slowly from the pins and you will have your chest up, your low back locked very tightly in extension, and your elbows straight. Then you shrug your shoulders back explosively, as if to touch the top of your traps to the back of your head. Now, this does not mean that the head moves back. It means that the top of the traps shrug back and up, not forward to the ears. Do not try to hold a position at the top. For each rep, catch the bar in the finished position of the deadlift and lower it back to the pins. Don't let the bar fall from the shrug back onto the pins without catching it at the hang. This is an excellent way to hurt your back or hips and bend your bar very badly. Each rep starts at and is returned to the pins. This requirement distinguishes a proper barbell shrug from incorrect versions in which all reps start from the hang and there's no explosive movement. The start from the pins using hip and leg drive to propel the bar up into the trap shrug is what allows the enormous weights to be used and what causes it to be such an effective exercise. Heavy shrugs make the traps grow. There's no doubt about it. At lighter weights, done with sets of five, at the 1 RM deadlift weight, they're good for cleans. At heavier weights, they prepare the traps for the top of the deadlift and prepare the brain for the feel of very heavy weight. The heavier sets will always be done with straps due to the snap that must be present at the top when the traps shrug the bar. One work set after warm-ups is enough. Sets across are extremely stressful due to the heavy skeletal loading involved in supporting this much weight, even for the brief time it takes to complete a rep. Likewise, barbell shrugs should be used conservatively in the schedule, maybe once every 2 weeks in the appropriately designed program. Now here's some notes about the power rack used in these exercises. The rack pull and the barbell shrug are best performed in the power rack, and its design is critical for these and all the other exercises in this program that can be done in one. A good rack should not be too expensive, and some of the simplest designs are actually the best. The rack should have a floor. It should not merely be on the floor, with you standing on something that is not also holding the rack down. A heavy plywood floor inside the rack and attached to the frame ensures that the weight of you and the loaded bar is always acting to stabilize the rack, so that when you set the bar back down on the pins, the rack does not move. Your position between the uprights will be determined by the depth of the rack, the distance between the front and back uprights. Shallow racks are a pain in the ass, and if the dimensions are wrong, the rack can be very hard to use. It should be deep enough to squat inside of, with some play front to back not being a problem. Drift during the set will occur no matter how careful you are, and if the uprights are so close together that you keep bumping them when you move a little, the quality of the set will suffer. If the rack is too deep, the pins will have too much bounce, because the long span between front and back uprights requires longer and therefore springier pins. Having the bar bouncing around on the pins is also disruptive during the set. The rack we prefer is 22 inches deep. If the rack is not wide enough, it can make loading the bar a problem. A narrow rack will allow an unevenly loaded bar, which they all are while being loaded, to tip. This and the fact that a narrow rack is potentially very hard on the hands when you're racking the squat makes a 48 to 49 inch wide rack outside to outside a very handy width for a power rack. The holes in the uprights should be on at least a 3 inch center or closer. This spacing allows for fine enough adjustments in height that it is useful for all exercises inside the rack, as well as for squatting and pressing outside the rack. Partial squats and presses. These same principles, using different versions of the parent exercise or portions of its range of motion as assistance exercises, which we lump together under the term partials, can be applied to squats and presses as well. Squats and presses, however, respond differently due to the fundamentally different nature of the exercises. The deadlift starts from the floor without a stretch reflex, distinguishing it from the squat in more ways than just the location of the bar. The hip and knee angles in the bottom of the squat are already more closed than at the start of the deadlift, and this longer range of motion is a terribly critical distinction between the two, since the added range of motion just happens to be in the most mechanically disadvantageous part. The only thing that mitigates this mechanically hard position is the stretch reflex rebound out of the bottom provided by the hamstrings, glutes, and adductors. Squats that start from a dead stop, removing the help provided by the stretch reflex, are quite useful when performed from different positions, just below parallel, well below parallel, and just above parallel. The pause makes the drive up very, very hard. A below parallel paused box squat for 5 reps might be only 50 to 60% of your 1RM. If you strengthen the squat at these positions from a dead stop, the explosion you must generate to start up from the bottom without the benefit of the mounts makes for a stronger squat when the bounce is added back in. Paused squats can be done in 2 ways, off a box or in the power rack. The box squat is an old training method that has worked effectively for several generations of lifters. The box is set up on the platform behind the lifter, another step back from the regular foot position for safety and backing up to the box. The box can be an actual box built of wood or metal for this purpose, a plyometric jump box, or even a stack of bumper plates. The height should be variable. The box should not slip against the platform or your butt when it's loaded, and it must be hell for stout. The stance is generally the same as for the squat, perhaps a little wider to allow the adductors to stretch a little more and increase their contribution from the dead stop. Take the bar out of the rack and step carefully back into a position that allows a firm contact with the box as your ass reaches back at the bottom. This distance may vary with the box, but in general, your heels will be parallel to the front edge of the box. If you're using stacked bumper plates, their radius will allow your heels to be a little behind the front of the plates. The squat itself will be an exaggeration of the correct form, with lots of attention paid to getting the hips back and the knees out to the sides and enough forward lean to stay in balance with this extreme hips back position. This exaggeration is needed because you're going to stop dead with no rebound and then drive your hips up from the pause below parallel. The difference in stance reflects the need to tighten up the bottom position for an exaggerated hip drive without a rebound. As you approach the box, slow down so you don't slap it with your butt. The purpose here is to load the box carefully to avoid compressing your back between the box and the loaded bar. Pause for a second or two and drive the hips straight up hard. Do not exhale at the bottom on the box. Air is support, and if ever in your life you needed to support your back, it will be at the bottom of a box squat. This exercise can be used for varying numbers of sets and reps, depending on the effect desired. The box can be varied in height from several inches below parallel to an inch or two, no more, above parallel. The deep versions use lighter weights, as mentioned earlier, and the high box version can be done with weights greatly exceeding a 1RM squat. And this alone should indicate how important it is to squat below parallel in your training. High squats are much easier to do with lots more weight because they are not a full range of motion exercise, and yes, a couple of inches does in fact make this much difference. A version of this exercise, known as the rocking box squat, developed at Westside Barbell in Culver City, California back in the 1960s, has the weight leaving the feet briefly as you rock back slightly and then coming back onto the feet before you drive your hips up hard off the box. But keep this in mind, box squats are an advanced exercise with a huge potential for injury if done incorrectly by inexperienced or physically unprepared trainees. The risk of spinal compression between the box and the bar is very high, and high school coaches should know better than to allow it. Please do not do them if you're not prepared. And this statement most definitely constitutes a disclaimer. Partial squats inside the rack. The other way to do partial squats is inside the power rack with the pin set at a height that produces the desired depth when the bar on your back touches the pins at the bottom. There are, amazingly enough, two ways to do these. The easy way is to set the pins at the desired depth, set up the hooks inside the rack, take the bar out of the hooks, squat down to a dead stop on the pins, and then come back up. This method permits you to get tight and store some elastic energy on the way down to the bottom, even without a bounce, preserving the effects of the eccentric and concentric order of things in tightness. The hard way is to load the bar on the pins at the desired bottom position, squat down under it, and get in position to squat at the bottom, under the bar, and then squat the bar up from what is most assuredly a very, very dead stop. This method is really a challenge at the lower reaches of depth and is hard with even light weights. As with box squats, they get easy at rack heights much above parallel, with so much quadricep and so little posterior chain muscle involved that they become good only for producing sore knees and beautiful quads. Bouncing the bar off the pins substitutes for the rebound that your hamstrings and adductors should be providing, thus defeating the purpose of doing the exercise in the rack. The bar should be lowered to the pins, fully stopped, and then driven up. The dead stop from the pins provides the same opportunity to work initial explosion out of the hole that box squats do, without the risk of any spinal entrapment compression. It is easier to get tighter at the bottom if you have had the whole trip down to the box or to the pins to do it. It is hard to get in an efficient position to squat if you have to do it while wadded up at the bottom, unable to stretch down into the bottom position from the correct position assumed at the top. There are advantages and disadvantages to each of these methods, but by the time you're ready to do partial squats, you'll have a feel for which one will work best for you. Just remember, again, this type of squat training is not for novice trainees. Note that these options do not include a half squat, which would be done from approximately the hip and knee angles as seen at the start of a deadlift. The half squat is an arbitrary position to start or stop in, since there is no anatomical reason to do so. The full squat works because the hamstrings and adductors achieve full stretch at this depth, but nothing good occurs at a half squat depth. The positions from which the squat can be trained with useful assistance exercises are all very close to the positions of the full range of motion. Training from the bottom up to the middle and then going back down is useful, as are all the variations that work up from the bottom with a pause to kill the rebound. The top half of the squat is very easy if the bottom is strong, since the top half is the mechanically easy part. Conversely, training the top will not strengthen the bottom. But unlike splitting up the deadlift, it is not very productive to divide the squat into upper and lower components and then training each one separately. The top does not need the work, and half squats are hard on the knees. And the bottom is the hard part of the squat anyway. In contrast, there is no easy part of a deadlift, and both halves of it can be successfully worked separately. Partial presses and bench presses. The press, like the deadlift, starts from a dead stop, at least for the first rep of a set and for a 1RM. Partial presses from different pin heights in the rack can be very useful assistance exercises. Dead stop explosion can be worked from every position the rack permits to be set and loaded, from eyeball level to lockout to overhead support work starting from locked out elbows. The bench press can be worked the same way as the squat inside the rack, with the dead stop assistance versions adding to the effectiveness of the rebound when the regular bench movement is resumed. For presses, set the pins at the desired position from chin level, which is just off the shoulders, on up, even as high as slightly below lockout, and press the bar off the pins with your standard press grip, keeping the bar close to your face with good elbow position and your chest up. Before it leaves the pins, tighten up against the bar, taking all the slack out of your elbows and shoulders before you try to make the bar move up. Make sure you preserve the critical movement of the torso under the bar. The higher the pins, the heavier the weight can be. The heavier the weight, the greater the instability at the top, the harder it becomes to prevent excessive layback, and the more stress the shoulders and abs will receive. A belt is a very good idea here. Resist the temptation to do lots of sets with weights heavier than you can press, especially the first time you try this. Pin positions in the middle of the movement, where most people get stuck, the point at about the top of the forehead where the transition from delts to triceps is trying to occur, are good places to apply this kind of work. And as a general rule, any partial exercise is quite useful when applied to the sticking points in its parent movement, and most of the partial exercises were developed specifically for this purpose. Reps can vary from sets of 3 to 10, but don't get carried away with a bunch of volume. Sets across from a dead stop will beat your shoulders up. So pick a weight, do it for the number of reps you want to use, and then adjust the weight in your next workout if you picked it wrong. The bench press can be used the same way, with the bar loaded on pins set at the desired height above the chest. Carefully center the flat bench so that it accommodates the correct position under the bar, with your head on the bench and your chest and elbows in the same place under the bar and in the same position they would be had you pressed the bar off your chest up to this level. As with the press, take all of the slack out of your elbows and shoulders before you push the bar up off the pins. This is important for correct mechanical execution and to prevent excessive dynamic shock to the tendon insertions on your humerus. Sets of 5 work well for both presses and bench presses, but again, just use the 1 heavy set. These are very stressful, and you will develop pec insertion tendonitis if you do too much work on partial exercises that allow the use of heavy weights from a dead stop. Shoulders are easier to injure and more susceptible to overuse than knees and hips are, and dead stop exercises with heavy weights tend to inflame the attachments pretty bad if they're used too often or at excessive volume. But if you don't get carried away by the glamour of the heavy weights that are possible because of the shorter range of motion, partial benches can make you very strong. You can also start either pressing movement from the lockout position at the top by setting the hooks inside the rack at this height, unracking the bar, lowering it to the pins, pausing and driving it back up as with a rack squat inside the rack. And as with the squat, a bounce off the pins defeats the purpose of the exercise. Its value lies in the fact that it allows sticking points to be worked from a dead stop. You must control the pause to prevent the bar from getting out of position on the pins. This version of the press is not commonly used, but it could be. More common is the board press, which uses varying thicknesses of lumber laid directly on the chest to make up the spacing for the partial. It was developed to strengthen the top of the movement after the use of the bench press shirt, which helps the lifter get the bar off the chest, became so commonplace in competitive powerlifting. The board press does not require a power rack, but does require the assistance of a spotter for the placement and removal of the board. Note that our photos of the pressing exercises show double pins under the bar position inside the rack. This is an important safety precaution for an exercise with the potential to hurt you if the supporting pin gets moved for any reason. Pins can actually slide out of the holes if you pull the bar toward the front of the rack with a relatively light weight, like you use in a partial press or a bench press, while it's resting on the pins. The second set of pins is set 1 level below your working height, and that can prevent a serious wreck. It's always a good idea for any partial movement inside the rack. Many versions of all these exercises have been developed by many people over the years and used with varying degrees of success. The key is good form, an understanding of the function and desired result of the exercise, and the judicious use of loading. So it appears that for all the basic exercises, the ones that normally use a stretch reflex as well as the ones that start from a dead stop, partial movements from a dead stop are useful. For the deadlift and the press, they mimic the mechanics of the parent movement by training the dead stop start from different positions within the range of motion. For the squat and the touch-and-go bench press, they make you generate all the upward movement without the help of a stretch reflex. Either way, they can be beneficial. But partial movements are not substitutes for the parent exercises. The full movement is the primary work, and the partial versions function as assistance work. If they were capable of replacing their parent exercises, they would have already. The full movement, by definition, involves muscles and neuromuscular details that the partial movement does not. The partial movement is therefore inferior to the whole parent exercise in its ability to improve performance. Even the deadlift is better than its partial derivatives. There are technical aspects to the deadlift that need to be practiced, and only experienced lifters should substitute haltings and rack pulls for the bigger, harder movement. For all these partial exercises that allow the use of heavier weights or harder positions, the point is to apply more or more specific stress than the parent exercise can produce. They must be used sparingly under the appropriate circumstances by trainees experienced enough to understand how and why. Squat variations. There are a couple of variations of the basic barbell squat that should be discussed. Front squats and high bar or Olympic squats are commonly used assistance exercises. They are not pieces of the back squat, but rather alternative versions of the parent movement that can be used as a substitute if need be. Opinions differ, and in the interest of full disclosure, they are described here. Olympic squats are preferred by many coaches over the low bar squat position described in this book. This could be because it requires no coaching. The high bar position on top of the traps is what a trainee will self-select unless made to do otherwise, and the knees forward position at the bottom is what happens in the absence of the intentional recruitment and use of the posterior chain. If you tell a kid to go over to the squat rack and do some squats, I'm of course, busy here teaching the highly technical and, might I add, much more rewarding to coach snatch and clean and jerk, and I don't really have time, so you just go over and do some squats. You know, put the bar on your back, squat down, stand back up. In other words, if you have him squat without teaching him how to do it, he will do a high bar squat. Coaches dealing with lots of trainees may prefer to just let them carry the bar high, thus relegating the question of bar position to an insignificant issue in the grand scheme of things. The high bar position is easier to get in for people with inflexible shoulders, and some older trainees with chronic shoulder problems have no choice but to squat this way. For them, it is obviously better than not squatting at all. Shoulder flexibility this bad sometimes improves, but sometimes, especially for older trainees, it doesn't improve much at all, especially if it is due to bony changes within the shoulder joint capsule. We've already discussed the reasons for preferring the low bar position, so here we'll just assume that the high bar position is the alternate version and that there is a compelling reason for using it. The high bar position requires that more attention be paid to keeping the chest up, which depends on upper back strength. The closer to vertical the back is, the smaller the effects of the longer back segment. This more upright position is also required if the squat is to stay in balance, since any squat is in balance only when the bar is over the middle of the feet. But the more upright the back and the more closed the knee angle, the less the hamstrings are involved in the movement. since the hips are already extended and the knees are more flexed. The further forward the knees are, the less involved the hips are. All these position requirements and leverage disadvantages make it necessary to use lighter loads in the Olympic squat than in the low bar version. If you decide that the high bar version might be useful, then use it as your standard squat and focus on the upright chest position. Hip drive will be greatly diminished, so it will not be useful as a cue. The front squat is a completely separate exercise for a couple of very important reasons. It varies enough from the squat that it should not be used by novices still trying to learn that movement. The front squat uses a different movement model than the squat, in that the hips are not the emphasis when the lifter is thinking about how to do it. The chest and the knees are the key to the front squat. The differences in the two movements are entirely due to the bar position on the shoulders. Any squat that is in balance will keep the bar over the midfoot while it is in the resting position at the top and as it travels down and up through the range of motion of the exercise. The low bar squat will thus be done with a back angle of somewhere between 30 and 50 degrees from the horizontal, depending on individual anthropometry, to permit the bar's vertical position over the feet. But in the front squat, since the bar sits on the anterior deltoids, with the elbows up and the hands trapping the bar in place all the way on the other side of the spine, the back angle must be nearly vertical to keep the bar over the midfoot and prevent it from falling off the shoulders. Front squats are missed when the weight is too heavy to squat or too heavy for the back to stay upright enough for the lifter to hold the bar in place. In either instance, the bar falls away forward. And since the back must stay nearly vertical, the knees and hips must facilitate this from the earliest part of the movement. In a front squat, the knees track forward and out, and the hips stay under the bar. This combination places the tibias in a much more horizontal position than in a squat, and this position significantly changes the mechanics around the knees and ankles, as well as the hips and lower back. The position of the bar determines the best way to drive up out of the bottom. The low bar squat uses a forceful, deliberate initial hip drive. The idea is to drive the butt straight up out of the bottom, which more effectively makes the glutes, hamstrings, and adductors contract. This hip drive is possible because the bar is low enough to place the lifter's back at an angle which permits it. Driving the butt up with the bar on the back just requires that the chest be maintained in a position, preserving the back angle. Hip drive does not work as well for the front squat. When the back is at a more horizontal angle, the hips present a surface, the top of the glutes, the sacrum, and lower part of the lower back, that a coach can touch with the hand and identify to the trainee. The coach can place his hand in this area and tell the trainee to push it up, a tactile cue that greatly improves the efficiency of the contraction of the muscles that produce the movement. The front squat has the hips directly under the bar, or as nearly so as possible, a position which presents no surface for cueing. The column of the torso stops at the chest and shoulders, and these, along with the elbows, are the surfaces that get cued. It will be observed that every heavy front squat, and indeed every heavy squat of every variation, will show some degree of initial hip drive. Whether you want it to or not, it is impossible to extend the hips without some change in back angle. But a focus on the chest, shoulders, and elbows, driving them up even as you lower the bar, preserves the vertical position that is so critical to finishing a heavy front squat. This focus is in stark contrast to the squats, both in position and in the way the movement is visualized. The differences are great enough that they should not get confused, but they quite often do, and for this reason, the front squat is best left alone until the squat's movement pattern is thoroughly embedded for a novice trainee. Since the front squat has such radically different form, you might expect that it should produce a different result than the squat. It does for the back, hips, and legs. The vertical back position of the front squat seems like it would result in a more direct compressional load on the spine than the squat's more horizontal angle would produce. This is partially true. The low back is in a nearly vertical position, but the upper back has a much tougher job because the load it is holding is further away, forward. The bar in a back squat, either low bar or high bar, sits right on top of the muscles that are holding it up. The front squat places the bar all the way across the depth of the chest, which in a bigger guy might be 12 or more inches. This distance is a moment arm that presents a mechanical challenge to the muscles that maintain thoracic extension. It's very common for lifters to get pretty sore between the shoulder blades when first starting to do the exercise. And since the bar is forward of the hips, too, there is also a moment arm against the hips, although not as long as in a squat, and certainly under a lighter load. So, while the lower back is vertically positioned, your thoracic erector muscles have a lot of work to do. What actually happens is a gradual shift from compression to moment, from low back to upper back, so things are not quite as simple as they seem. The load on the lumbar spine in the front squat is friendlier because it will be lighter as long as the upper erectors can maintain position, and for this reason, many people find front squats to be easier on the low back. But this also means that the front squat is a less effective back exercise than the squat. When you front squat, don't worry about your back, worry about your knees. To facilitate the vertical back, they have to track forward so that the hips can stay directly under the bar. This means that the shins will be much more horizontal at the bottom of the front squat, with a closed knee angle, dorsiflexed ankles, and a lot more moment force operating along the tibias than there is in a squat. For most people, these factors will mean contact between calf muscles and hamstrings at the bottom, and sometimes a rather dynamic loading of the Achilles tendons and quadriceps. For some people, this closed knee angle will create enough wedging on the posterior knee cartilage that it can produce instability and injury, a situation that essentially never happens in a properly performed low bar squat. For everybody, the job of opening the knee angle through a much greater range of motion with muscles working against more moment force because of a more horizontal shin angle is much harder. Since the front squat places the knees so much further forward than they are at the bottom of the squat, the hamstrings are not nearly as involved in the hip extension. In the front squat, the vertical back and pelvic position and the acute angle of the tibias place the hamstrings in a position where the origin and insertion points are closer together, so that the muscle bellies are shortened. If the hamstrings are already contracted, they cannot contract much more, and thus cannot contribute much to hip extension. The hamstrings' role in the front squat is to maintain the vertical back angle, and their already contracted position prevents them from contributing much force to drive out of the bottom, or much force to support a more horizontal back angle. But the hips must still extend, so the glutes and adductors end up doing most of the job without the help of the hamstrings. The knees forward, vertical back position, puts the quads in a position to do most of the work, since most of the angle to open will be the knee angle. Three of the four quadriceps muscle bellies cross only the knee joint, so any exercise that extends the knee will involve most of the quads every time. The difference in the front squat is that very noticeable glute soreness, the result of the eccentric use of the glutes without the help of the hamstrings, is usually the result the first few times you do it. So So the primary difference between the squad and the front squad is one of degree in terms of the amount of involvement from the contributing muscle groups. The knee's forward position increases the moment force on the tibias, making the mechanics of knee extension less efficient. At the same time, the contribution of the hips is diminished by the vertical back position. The net effect is that you cannot front squat as much weight as you can squat in the low bar position. And the primary reason for the difference is the position in which the system is in balance. The bar in both cases must be over the middle of the foot, and the resulting correct back angle is the one that keeps it there. Learning the front squat is best done from the power rack or squat stand. The bar is set at the same position as for a back squat, the level of the mid-sternum. The grip must allow your elbows to come up high enough that your shoulders can support the load while your back remains vertical during the movement.